state where he...
Although he prefers not to be categorized, few musicians can draw upon as rich a tradition as my next guest. But he's been performing professionally for more than 60 years, has won a Grammy and a National Medal of Arts, and he's here today to talk about his autobiography, Man of Constant Sorrow, written with Eddie Dean and published by Gotham Books. It's a great honor to welcome back to our show one of the key figures in bluegrass and mountain music, Dr. Ralph Stanley. Hello.
Good to be here. How are you doing?
And we just were listening to a version of A Man of Constant Sorrow, which you recorded some years back. How many times have you recorded it? Do you know?
I've recorded it several times. I believe that cut there was made back in the early 50s.
And when did the song become your signature song?
Well, I've been singing that song ever since I was just a little boy. And that'd be up several years. Yeah.
It even became part of the plot of the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou by Joel
right.
and Ethan Coen. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I don't know how that happened. You know, the version that they used on the movie there, you know, why we arranged that back in the 50s. That's the cut right there. And that's sort of the cut that they recorded.
Mm-hmm, because that gave a real sense of authenticity.
Right, yeah.
In an interview in the New York Times, you said that you didn't like the term bluegrass. Nowadays, some people would call what you do roots music. Is that better for you, or how would you describe your music?
Well, I call my music old-time mountain music, all the way back from the roots, you know, the way it started.
Now, do you spell old time with an E and time with a Y?
I guess.
So it's old time music. It's the music you grew up with.
Right.
Do you know where that music comes from?
Well, now the music that I do, I guess it was just sort of originated by my brother and me, mm-hmm. which just the way that we learned to play from little boys up. And
It probably comes out of the old English tradition.
I would say.
I can hear the religious side of your music. Did you grow up singing in the church?
Very much so, yes, sir.
An awful lot of traditional singers have. That's where they began. But when did you start hearing secular music?
Well, I was a small boy. It was way back maybe when I was 12 or 13 years old. You know, we heard the... Heard the radio, heard people doing it, something like 38 or 9, 40, somewhere along there.
So you heard it on the radio. You didn't hear it from local performers?
No, I didn't hear it on the local.
You're known as a man of a few words. Was it hard to write this book?
Well, yeah, in a way it was. Of course, we took our time and had plenty of time. My worst trouble was, you know, I've been in it so long is remembering everything. Just like it was, and I wanted to make it as much as I could just like it was there, you see. And I had a hard time remembering.
But it comes across, it almost feels like we're sitting around and having some chats and you're remembering old stories. Most of music biographies of this sort are cut and dry, but this one, your voice really comes through.
Well, thank you. I've done my best.
And Eddie Dean obviously did his best. Let's talk a bit about the circumstances you grew up in. You grew up, as you said, singing in the church and not hearing much secular music. Would you have considered yourself poor when you were a kid?
Well, in a way, I mean, I wouldn't call it the poorest, but we were a long ways from being rich.
And this was in Kentucky?
Southwestern part of Virginia.
Virginia.
Yes, sir.
What did you think you would do when you grew up, or did you not think about those sorts of
things? Well, after we started hearing some of this singing, when I say we, I'm talking about my brother and myself, we decided right away we wanted instruments and we wanted to learn to pick and make our living that way. And we even wanted it so bad, you know, you used to cut this kindling wood to build a fire with, and there's a stick about a foot long, that kindling we called it. And we made our instruments out of that piece of wood. We'd hold that and pick it for the instrument. We wanted something to pick that bad.
So you chose to play banjo. So you came up with a kind of a banjo of sorts out of kindling wood?
Yeah, I mean, we just called that for our called it an instrument, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a long ways from it, but we didn't have any strings on it or anything. But it's just something to hold and go through the motion.
That like kind of like air guitar today.
Right.
But when you did start playing, you chose banjo. Why banjo?
I chose the banjo because I liked the sound of it, and it was an easier instrument for me to play, and I just... Like I say, I liked the sound, and I thought I could do a better job on the banjo.
You play in the clawhammer style. How is that the way most banjo players play?
Well, not now, you know. Well, there's still a lot of clawhammer, but back in the early days, I guess that was the way they started playing the banjo, was the clawhammer. I know my mother played the clawhammer, but... That's been years ago.
And what does clawhammer mean? Is it the way you hold?
It's the way
your
you do
left hand.
The way you do your use your hand. If it's clawhammer, you don't use any picks on your fingers. And I use my two fingers to hit the rhythm with, and a thumb to carry on to connect up and carry on the sound of clawhammer and pick down on it instead of up.
And did you pick it up right away?
Yeah.
Were you able to play well?
Yeah, I did. I don't know how well I learned to play, but I was doing something.
You and your brother Carter Stanley formed the Stanley Brothers and the Clinch Mountain Boys in 1946. How old were you at the time?
1946. I was born in 1927. What would that have been? I
19 years old.
19. Well, yeah. But I mean, we started.
Wait, you said 1936? 46.
Yeah, 46. Yeah. That's when 19. We started playing, but, I mean, professionally. That's when we started professionally. But we was about 9 or 10 years old when we first started, got our instruments and so forth.
Well, the group played on a radio station in Bristol, Virginia. How important was radio to developing a career in those days?
Well, it was the only way back those days, you know. You didn't have any... other way, no TV or anything, just and there wasn't too many radio stations to listen to, but that was the only way of getting it out to the public.
Do you think that it's easier to harmonize with a relative than with somebody else?
Yes, I do.
You and your brother, because your voices were kind of similar?
Yeah, in a way, and then if you're born together and you're raised together and you sleep together and you talk to each other all the time, you begin to talk alike, and then naturally you're a blood kin. Well, you've got it in you.
And if you get along, some brothers get along better than others.
Well, yeah. Now I don't think any brothers gets along good all the time. I know I've had a few little rows with my brother, but they usually ended as fast as they started.
You signed with Columbia Records in 1949, and the songs that you recorded there are considered by many to be among the best in the entire history of bluegrass. Would you call them bluegrass?
You know, actually...
Could be old-time music then, because yeah, it was... That is the old time.
Yeah, you know, actually, I don't know what bluegrass is.
Well, the Monroe Brothers actually... they call themselves the Bluegrass Boys, and they're similar. They probably were your chief rivals, weren't they?
Yeah, Bill Monroe, you know, he done more than he did with his brother Charlie, but I would call Bill Monroe bluegrass. And the only difference I can see is just a little bit more polished. Ours is more, I guess, rougher and old timey and down to earth.
And for a while, you had a very serious rivalry. There was bad blood.
Had
no?
What?
With Bill Monroe.
Well, it didn't amount to much. I mean, it's in the end why we became the best of friends, and all of that vanished.
And you say late in the book, you talk about how Bill Monroe killed and cured a whole hog for you. That's friendship.
He certainly did. He brought it, killed it, and salted it down, and brought it in a washing tub from Nashville to Norton, Virginia, to me, and already had it ready to cure, you know, with salt. Had it all done for me.
My guest is Dr. Ralph Stanley, who's written with the help of Eddie Dean, Man of Constant Sorrow, My Life and Times. It is published by Gotham Books. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break and listen to some music by Ralph Stanley.
On a high, on a high holiday, on the very best day of the year, little Matthew Grove to the church did go, the holy word to hear. And some come in all dressed in white, some in purple and blue, and then come in Lord Arnold's wife, a flower among the few. Won't you spare me over till another year? Well, what is this that I can't see with ice cold hands taking hold of me? Well, I am death, none can excel. I'll open the door to heaven or hell. Oh, death, someone would pray, could you wait to call me another day? The children prayed, the preacher preached, time and mercy is out of your reach.
This is Oh, Death, from the soundtrack of the Coen Brothers film, Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?, sung by Ralph Stanley. We went into the break with one of his more recent recordings, Little Matthew Grove. That's from just about 7 years ago. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Also led to a concert film, Down from the Mountain, and a tour that brought you to Carnegie Hall. And didn't you just play Carnegie Hall again with Steve Martin?
Played it, last week, yeah.
Does it seem less awe-inspiring the second time around?
Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it both times. Well, that makes about three or four times I've played the Carnegie Hall.
Well, the acoustics are great there. I don't know how it compares to the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, they're really good, I'll have to say. They're really good.
How much touring do you keep up these days?
I'd say right now something like 100 shows a year.
Wow, that's an awful lot. How old do you now?
I'm just 82.
Mm-hmm. You don't ever get tired?
Well, I sometimes get a little bit tired, but you just have to hang in there.
Because there are a lot of musicians who say, you know, I just got tired of touring and I'm going to have to find another way to make a living.
Yeah.
That never occurred to you?
Well, no. Right now, it never has yet. You know, I've been on the road now, regular for 63 years.
In the early days, it was all by car, wasn't it?
Yeah, now that was the rough days. Of course, you didn't have near as far to travel, you know, where we traveled 100 miles back then, well, we travel 1,000 now, but we have a bus now, and it's a lot more, you know, easy to do.
So you would book according to the mileage. You would try to book each show 100 miles from the last show.
Yeah, right. We would have to get back, go play the show, you know, and get back for the next day, midday, to do a radio show. So we couldn't play too far on account of that.
You were in a serious automobile accident in 1951. Did you think that would end your musical career?
Not really. It didn't. It didn't hurt me that bad. I mean, you know, it was a bad wreck, but I soon got over it. It didn't hurt me that bad.
What was a show like in those days in the 50s? You did religious songs, secular songs, instrumentals, even comedy material?
Yeah. We used to have a comedian, though. We called him a funny man, and about the same as they are now, you know, singing, playing instrumentals, and just a sort of variety. I always get a lot of requests. I ask for requests from the show. They might want a fiddle tune, a banjo tune, or might want a gospel song or a heart song, and I try to do what they like.
The sort of thing that Hee-Haw tried to duplicate, although it doesn't sound like it was as authentic as what you were doing.
Well, it might not have been, but, you know, I liked the old brother show that we had, what to call Down from the Mountain, and I was sort of in charge of that, you know, I handled that, and I guess I don't want to brag on myself, but I guess I've done a pretty fair job.
Well, considering the fact that most people today associate you with Man of Constant Sorrow and Oh Death, It may come as a shock that you did some comedy material, and maybe we could play the beginning of Still Trying to Get to Little Rock so our listeners can get a sense of the kind of humor you had in the act in the old days.
Okay.
Stranger, don't tell me you're still trying to get to Little Rock.
I sure am, and I just wondered if I could cross the river down there.
That river right over there? I expect you can. I saw about 7 or 8 ducks cross it a while ago.
Well, do you know how deep it is?
No, I couldn't tell you that, buddy, but I do know one thing. There's water all the way at the bottom.
Also gave you a chance to do a lot of picking.
Right.
The loss of your brother Carter in 1966 must have been a terrible blow. Didn't he handle most of the business details for the group?
No. Now, Carter did the front work. He did the MC work and things like that on the stage.
Wrote some of the songs?
I did the business, and he did the, you know, the all the MC work and most of that, everything like that.
Did you think about quitting the business after Carter died?
Well, I didn't want to, but I didn't know, since he had handled, you know, done the stage work and everything, whether I could maybe hold the job down.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in probably 6 weeks' time, I got hundreds of cards and letters, phone calls saying, "We hope you've never thought about quitting. And be sure and don't, because we're going to be for you now more than we ever was, because we know you'll need it."
It still must be daunting to try to replace somebody like Carter. You relied on him. You always knew where his voice would be when you're doing harmony.
That's right, yeah.
And many listeners may not realize that tragedy has dogged the Clinch Mountain Boys. You describe how lead singer Roy Lee Centers was shot and pistol-whipped and left to die in a creek in Breathitt County, Kentucky. What was that all about?
Well, that was an awful shock to me, too. From what I can understand, I never did hear much straight of it. He was just out... We just got back from California on a tour, and he'd went out with a friend to a party, and maybe they got into it over, I don't know, but they had a difference, and the man that I was told him, he said, get in the car, and I'll take you home. Well, he took him so far, and he turned off on a different road away from home. And he said, "This ain't the way home." He said, "I know it's not." He said, "I'm taking you out to kill you."
Wow. Mm-hmm. Was it dangerous to be a touring musician in those days?
Not really. I don't know.
This was just an exceptional situation.
Yeah.
But then your singer Keith Whitley died quite young because he had real problems with alcohol.
Yeah, that I understand. And, you know, you never know what kind of troubles a man can have by looking at him, but...
Well, you must have talked to him about it.
No. See, Keith had already left me at that time, and I didn't mention nothing like that to him. It was a shock and a surprise to me.
Well, there are happier things. The soundtrack to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou won several Grammys. It sold almost 8 million records and really changed the way that the industry looked on bluegrass and Americana music, old-time music as you describe it. With all that activity, why is it so hard for that music to be heard on radio these days? What do you think?
Well, I think that's one reason that made it more popular at that time. It was played more on the radio, where there's more people could hear it. Maybe they might have heard it one time, but they didn't pay any attention to it. And it over doubled my popularity. After that, after that old brother.
I assume also you started getting higher fees.
Right.
And then you got a doctorate. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I got that in 1976 from Lincoln Memorial University, Harrogate, Tennessee. I went to that college and had classes for about 6 weeks and had people come in from different states to enroll for so long a time. And when we finished up, then that's the way I got the honorary doctor.
My guest is Dr. Ralph Stanley, who has been performing professionally for over 60 years, awarded a Grammy in 2002 for his song, Oh Death, which was was featured on the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. In 2006, he was awarded the National Medal of Arts, and now he's written, with the help of Eddie Dean, an autobiography called Man of Constant Sorrow, My Life and Times. It is published by Gotham Books. This is the Leonard LoPate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. Most people, I think, most listeners would assume that a country or a bluegrass or an old-time musician would be politically conservative, but didn't you endorse Barack Obama in the presidential elections and even made a radio ad for him?
Yeah, I did. I endorsed him and made some radio ads for him.
Did you get any flack for that?
No, I didn't.
Which is probably a change. It might have been quite different in the 50s if you had done something like that.
Well, it probably would, I guess, yeah. Everything changes as time goes on.
You have also been inducted into the Grand Ole Opry, the International Bluegrass Music Hall of Fame. And as I said before, you got the National Medal of Arts in 2006. Which one of those things meant the most for you?
I got on the Grand Ole Opry in 2000, and I was real proud to get on the Grand Ole Opry. I hadn't actually tried through the years much to get on the Opry. Well, when I did try, I made it. And
What took them so long? Didn't they just call you? After all, you seemed an appropriate act for them.
Well, no, I don't think they called. Bill Monroe went in with me one time to try to work that out with the Grand Ole Opry, but we didn't get it worked out. But, while Bill was there, they had what they wanted, I guess. And after he passed on then, that left a spot open for somebody like me.
I like what you wrote about playing music. You said, I've always liked plain and simple picking the best. I think you ought to play every note like the song calls for, no more and no less.
Well, I always tried to play the banjo. I always tried to make that banjo speak that word just like I sung it. I guess that sounds crazy, but it's just the way I felt it, and I just wanted my fingers to make it feel like my voice did.
Well, as I understand it, the history of instrumental music is that people wanted to make instruments sound like voices, and then they wanted to make voices sound like instruments. Mm-hmm. And to some degree, that's what you've been able to do.
Well, some people, tries to do that, and then some, they play it a little bit wild, and I don't really know what they're playing.
Mm.
But that's why I always wanted to sound like a singer.
You tell a lot of funny stories in here. The book is full of practical jokes and hijinks. Even while you were receiving an honorary degree at Lincoln Memorial, the Clinch Mountain Boys are back in the motel throwing firecrackers at each other. So,
yeah.
Overgrown kids?
Yeah, I reckon. I remember that. There was one, Curly Lambert. He was he was bald-headed. He didn't have any hair. And Keith Whitley and I was into that. And they bought firecrackers and just, got in the room and was lighting them and throwing them, hitting him in the head with them, so that's what that was.
Now, you had a couple of Curlies in the group. You had Curly Ray as well.
Curly Ray Klein.
Also bald?
Curly Ray had more hair than three or four men.
Because you tell a funny story about him and how he stashed all of his pay in mason jars in the basement.
I was doing what?
He was stashing all of his pay in mason jars in his basement.
Yeah, just anywhere he could put it in a gallon jug or just anywhere he could put it. That's where he'd have it.
that was his banking method?
Yeah, and he was afraid. He wouldn't risk it in the bank. He didn't want anybody to know what he had.
Well, over the years, you've been performing for 60 years. It probably is almost impossible for you to count up all the different musicians you've played with and that you've met. Mm-hmm. Any really stand out for you?
I don't know where any stands out as much as Curly Ray, all around. I'd say Curly had the record.
And are you still recording? You have a new record coming out?
No, I haven't recorded any for a few years now, but I'm thinking about doing maybe one more CD, maybe a gospel CD.
And these are songs that you would have sung before?
No, I would like to get all new songs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, new songs or not old, not traditional songs that you make new?
No, just maybe someone's written, just some new material.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always an honor when Dr. Ralph Stanley comes on the show, and I can't recommend his autobiography, Man of Constant Sorrow, My Life and Time, strongly enough. It really does paint a vivid picture of a life devoted to music and a culture that people in New York just are not as aware of as maybe they should be. So, and we're going to go out by letting our listeners hear how great a banjo player you are with a Stanley Brothers instrumental called Five String Drag. The book, Man of Constant Sorrow, My Life and Times, written by Dr. Ralph Stanley and Eddie Dean and published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it.